Morning, West Side. Well, hey, I have always enjoyed, like, the challenge of living on less. Hiking and camping in the backcountry has a way of teaching these lessons pretty effectively. And when, you know, it's all on your back, you don't really want to carry around out there in the backcountry a bunch of things that you don't need. So you really learn to pare down to just the basics. And it doesn't take long, actually, to realize when you're out there that, you know what, as long as you've got some calories and some drinkable water and a way to get warm and stay dry and maybe some good company, man, you're good. Life is good. Life is actually quite good when it is just stripped down to its simplest form. And I've actually, you know, over the years, I think I've gotten pretty good at living on less. And when I'm living on less, that's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. It's really more of a fork in the road. It's really up to me to decide to go in the direction of greed or in the direction of generosity. If I go in the direction of greed, I'm living on less so that I can have more, so that I can accumulate more. And if I go in the direction of generosity, I'm living on less so that I can give more. And I often find myself at that fork in the road, staring at these two options before me, knowing that the way that looks riskier is actually my safest option. And the way that feels safest is actually the far more dangerous way for me to go. So Paul, the Apostle Paul, had been planting churches all over Asia Minor, all over the place in the first century. And of course, he planted a church, or maybe a network of churches, in Ephesus, which was a major Greco-Roman metropolis. Lots of education, lots of culture, lots of money went through Ephesus. And of course, you know, like any church, it developed some problems that needed to be dealt with. And, you know, it developed some of these issues after Paul had moved on to go plant churches elsewhere. And so he was looking for someone to go and resolve the problems. Well, Paul had mentored a guy named Timothy since he was just a wee little lad. And so Paul sent Timothy to go resolve the issues in Ephesus. And he wrote some letters to Timothy instructing him, coaching him on how to do this. And one of the problems that needed to be dealt with fell in the category of money problems. Not the kind of, you know, can't pay the bills kind of money problems, but actually the opposite kind. The kind of problems that can accompany affluence. Apparently, there were some super spiritual teachers and influencers there in Ephesus starting to influence people in the church community, leveraging the gospel for financial gain. Maybe charging for their messages, charging people money for their insights, we're not really sure. But whatever they were doing, Paul says that they were attempting to use their godliness, use godliness to get rich. And that is, of course, a problem on multiple levels, right? I mean, just at a basic level, it's foolish because it's using this far greater thing, godliness, as a means of grabbing hold of this far lesser thing, financial gain. I mean, that's just classic foolishness right there. And at another level, it's just misaligned with the teachings of Jesus because it seems just totally unaware of the kind of simple living that Jesus taught. But at a deeper level, it's dangerous, because it demonstrates a love of money. Now you might, when I say that phrase, you might be familiar with what Paul said about the love of money, chasing after riches. Here's what he says to Timothy. He says, Timothy, people who want to be rich, who chase after that, who seek being rich, they fall into temptation and a trap, into many foolish and dangerous lusts, which drown people in devastation and destruction. And here's what he says. He says, for the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. There it is. That is quite a statement right there. And that line is often, maybe you've heard it misquoted, to say that money is the root of all evil. But that would actually be saying something different. as if money itself is an evil thing. And you know, honestly, you might believe that to be true, but that's not the Bible's perspective. In the Bible's view, money is neutral, neither good nor evil. It could be used for good, it could be used for wickedness, whatever. But the love of money, one's attachment to money, one's prioritization of and subsequent enslavement to money, well, that's a different story. That simple emotional affair of the heart, as common as it might be, it is a root that, if planted in a human heart, can grow into every other kind of sin. Can it grow into murder? Love of money into murder? Of course. Envy? All the time. Can it grow into deceit, self-centeredness, idolatry, impatience, impoliteness? Of course. Any of those. Lust? Sure. And every other kind of disordered desire. Now, of course, there's plenty of other ways to get to those evil outcomes that don't start, that don't originate with the love of money. But the love of money, that particular greed, is a unique root because it gives way, it can give way to every other kind of evil. Paul's got a great line for Timothy on this point. It's a real zinger for those who want to be rich. He says, tell him this, say, gain? You want gain? You want more? He says this, if it's gain you want, there is plenty of gain to be had in godliness if it's combined with contentment. He's like, yeah, there is indeed a kind of gain that does go along with godly living. As long as the godliness is mixed with contentment, the belief that you already have enough, which is, of course, precisely the opposite of a desire for more, a desire for gain, right? Paul's pointing out such a profound irony, maybe a rich irony. He says, he's basically saying, you make the greatest gains by realizing you don't need more. You're looking for a get-rich-quick scheme? This might be it right here. That might be the fastest way of getting rich right here. Simply realize that you already have enough, and that will make you richer than the richest person on earth. We'll come back to that thought here in a little bit. But that's what Paul has for those who desire, who are chasing after becoming rich. But what's Timothy supposed to do with all the other people in his churches who maybe are already rich? They're not chasing after it. They just found themselves in the situation. You know, those people who didn't ask to be born into the circumstances that they were born into. They're not seeking to have more than they already need, or more than they need. They already have more than they need. He says, Timothy, what about people who are already rich in this present world? Tell them this. Tell them not to think of themselves too highly, obviously, right? Tell them to avoid arrogance. Avoid thinking that they're more valuable than others. And tell them this. Tell them to set their hopes not on something so uncertain as riches, but rather on the God who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. It's a great line. Do you consider yourself rich? Now, no matter how much you make, no matter your income, you probably don't. And that's because rich, having more than enough wealth, is a label that we far more often use for others, but rarely ourselves. Very few of us think of ourselves as rich. Well, let me ask you this. How much more would you have to make in order to consider yourself rich? Well, if you're like most, according to studies, you would need to basically make about 2 times more than you currently make. In your head, that's probably where the rich threshold is located. So if you make $30,000, then $60,000 is when you start getting rich. If you make $50,000, then $100,000 is when you start being rich. Millionaires point to billionaires. Even the billionaires always have someone else to compare themselves to. So just like you have this tendency to label others rich, You got to know that there's countless other people in this world who, if they were to walk through your life for just a day, they would conclude you are rich. See, rich is a mindset, not an income bracket. Rich is really better understood as an honest self-admission, an acknowledgement that we already have more than we need, rather than a label that we put on someone else. So I know, you probably don't believe me when I tell you that you're rich, but you probably are. So what? So what if I am rich? What do I do with that? Well, Paul says this. He says, set your hopes not on something so uncertain as riches, but rather on the God who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. Riches are such an incredibly uncertain thing to put your hope in, aren't they? I mean, seriously, come on. Have you saved enough for the future? You got enough insurance? You got enough in your emergency fund for the next emergency? How could you possibly know that? You have enough to retire on? How could you know that? You don't even know how much eggs are going to cost next week. How could you possibly know if you have amassed enough riches for what the future might bring? You don't know. In his little book, quick read, Be Rich, that's what it's called, Be Rich, Andy Stanley points out something that we have to realize. It's this, that you can never have enough to protect yourself from every possible outcome. You can't do that. And so at some point, you got to realize that in order to let go, in order to decide that you have enough. Yes, sure, saving is absolutely wise. Financial planning. Absolutely wise. Insurance and retirement plans. Yeah, that's probably just basic smarts. But heads up, when we do that at even a most basic level, heads up, we get pulled in the direction of putting our hope in riches, and we have to pull in the opposite direction to compensate. We have to pull in the opposite direction with this realization that it is God who provides for us. He is the one who richly provides. We put our hope in him who richly provides for our enjoyment. Did you catch that? As if he's like this dad, this joyful, content dad who actually enjoys giving good gifts to his kids for them to enjoy. Honestly, this has been a hard one for me. That's a hard insight for me. Because honestly, throughout my life, it's been more tempting for me to believe that if the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, then it makes sense that the hatred of money, the contempt for money, is the way to uproot the problem, right? I would actually characterize a phase of my adolescence and early adulthood in this way. I would come back from a mission trip to some impoverished, developing country, thinking that the right thing for me to do is to turn up the guilt in my life, right? To get angry, to resent myself for having so much more than others. I remember walking through a marketplace in one of these countries, you know, stray dogs that you don't touch, little open sewage behind these corrugated metal shops selling things of minimal value. And with my watch on my wrist, one of those old digital cameras in my pocket, the shoes that I was wearing that day, I remember concluding that I am probably wearing more wealth on my person right now than some of these people around me have in their whole, to their whole name, and it made me angry. I wanted to hate the various financial opportunities that come simply from being born in this time and place. I remember having just gotten off the plane, driving by a strip mall that had some kind of, I don't know, like a pet grooming service center in it, you know? And I remember noticing that in a new way. I remember noticing it as a mark of the level of luxury that I had otherwise been completely accustomed to. I was thinking, I am from a society in which it's totally normal to pay someone to give my dog a bath and a haircut. Well, that's like, that's normal. That had never seemed strange to me before, never uncomfortable to me before. But after spending some time with people, new friends, who couldn't dream of such affluence overflowing into animals, it made me sick to my stomach, angry at my wealth, angry at myself for being one of the rich ones in this world. And that was a helpful phase for me to go through, I think, and grow out of, too. That kind of anger and contempt, it was useful to God for a time in my life, but I don't think that's really where he ever intended for me to live. That's not what gets us home. That kind of chemotherapy, it does, yeah, definitely kills some greed, which is great. But it might kill other things too. And it certainly doesn't foster the kind of generosity, joyful, life-giving generosity that God is trying to grow in us. See, true generosity, the kind that God demonstrates, the kind that he enjoys, it grows not from the soil of contempt, contempt for money, contempt for the rich, but rather it grows from the soil of contentment. Do you know, have you learned yet how to enjoy what you already have? Have you learned this, the secret to enjoying what's already yours? Contrary to popular belief, it is not by taking a picture of it, actually. Maybe you think it's by, you know, slowing down, by savoring it in the moment, the present moment. Well, that's getting closer. But actually, I think it's a little further than that. It's the surest way to enjoy what you have is to simply thank God for it. Turn that moment of pleasure into a moment of worship. The way to keep that pleasure is to release it in the form of a prayer. The way to really hold on to the joy of it forever, to embrace it forever, is to release a prayer of thanks to God. That's how you keep it. Do you remember that common COVID symptom, the loss of taste? That ever happened to you? I mean, isn't that a weird symptom? Well, not a strange kind of misery, isn't it? I mean, you know, you could breathe, so you were certainly counting that blessing, but you lost your sense of taste. The best, most flavorful food ever prepared on planet Earth could be on your fork and in your mouth, but you couldn't enjoy it as such. Wouldn't that be a strange kind of misery, to be rich? To have a life abounding with blessing from God, having everything except for one thing, the ability to enjoy it. The desire for more and the fear of not having enough, those things kill our enjoyment of what we already have. Gratitude and contentment are the way to restore it. Little exercise for you right now. Go ahead and put your hand on your shirt. Pretty sure everybody's got one on this morning. Thank you. Go ahead and look down at it. Look at your shirt. Don't look at mine. Look at yours. Maybe take the corner of your shirt, get it in between your fingertips so you can feel it, feel its texture. I want you to consider the texture. Consider the color. And go ahead and whisper a prayer to God right now, giving thanks for the shirt that's on your back. Next, go ahead and wiggle your toes. Just wiggle them just enough to feel your sandals or your shoes or whatever you got on your feet. And thank God for whatever's on your feet right now. That layer of protection between the bottom of your foot and the hot, hard pavement outside. And I suppose if you happen to be barefoot, TJ, you can thank him for how good it is to be barefoot in June. And here, a little later, when you climb into your car or whatever you came here in or on, before you ride away, would you take a moment to whisper a thank you to God for that thing? And when you get home today, at some point today, I want you to take just 5 or 10 minutes, put your phone in a drawer, quietly move through your home, looking at, even touching with your fingertips, the things in your home, material things. Some things that make your life just a little bit easier. Thank God for those things. Things that are in place to look pretty. Thank God for those things. Things that have history to them. Thank God for those things. I want you to look at each of those things that you would like to replace someday. All those things that maybe partially work or maybe aren't quite right for whatever reason. Resist the temptation to make a shopping list. This time, thank God for those things. And of course, if you have no home and you have had nothing but a rock for your pillow, put your hand on that rock and thank God for a flat place to lay your head. And please do talk to me after the service, because I'm pretty sure there's a couple thousand of us who would like to get you a pillow. And as you walk through your life today, thanking God for just a tiny portion of what he has provided for you to enjoy, you just see if you don't feel somehow, in some way, richer. Paul says, Timothy, tell the rich not to put their hope in their riches, but rather put their hope in a God who richly provides for their enjoyment. Tell them to be rich in a different way. They are to do good, he says, to be rich in good works, generous, eager to share. Instead of having money, having more money than you need, do more good things than you need to do. Instead of aiming to abound in wealth, be abounding, overflowing. Be rich in good works, not dollars. Forget about expendable income. Be excessively generous. Instead of gaining financially by saving, learn to gain. Learn the real treasures come from sharing. That way, he says, they will treasure up for themselves a good foundation for the future, and thereby come to possess the life which really is life. What's he talking about here? Storing up future treasures? Is he talking about, you know, after death, cashing in our good works for a reward? Like, the more we give and sacrifice in this life, the bigger our mansion will be in the next one? Is that how it works? A lot I don't know. I don't know about mansions. But I do know this. That foundational to all Christian behavior is the hope of resurrection. We believe that God will someday, in a final and complete way, share his life, the kind of life that he himself enjoys with those who are in Jesus. And the glories of that life will far outweigh whatever suffering we endure in this life. That is the hope that we fix our eyes on. And that hope, basic to Christian living, clearly fueled not only the earliest Christians, but actually every generation of Christians throughout history, fueling them to live generously and give fearlessly, totally unafraid of what might happen to them, because they know that their present suffering in this life isn't even worth comparing to the glory in the next. Totally unafraid, because they know that their light and momentary troubles and inconveniences now are achieving for them an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. Now I know that Christians do not have a perfect track record. Plenty of embarrassing marks on church history. But you gotta admit, when you look at Christian generosity through the ages, it's pretty staggering. from programs that care for widows there in Ephesus that Timothy's, you know, making happen and being responsible for, all the way to the 3rd and 4th century development of whole hospitals, nursing homes, leper colonies, orphanages, homes for the homeless, agricultural training, microfinance programs, language centers and schools, churches that change whole cities through their giving. When you step into this building right here, into this church family right here, you got to realize you are stepping into a centuries-long legacy of generosity that stretches all the way back to the day that an unimaginably rich king came into our world as a peasant to begin generously sharing all of the riches of his kingdom with his subjects. And when he did, he said, "I came that they might have life and have it abundantly." And as strong as our hope is in this abundant life after death, I actually don't think it's the only thing that's been motivating Christian generosity through the ages. Matter of fact, I don't think it's the only kind of life that Paul has in view either. I mean, look at the phrases that he uses. A good foundation for the future. Coming to possess the life which really is life. See, his language here is sufficiently vague enough to include both a life of abundance after death and the way that that very life reaches back into our present time, reaches back into our very near future. His language allows for the possibility of a kind of resurrection life that we can experience right now, today, long before our death. And I think many of you already know that life. You'll notice that whenever we talk about money around here, we're very careful not to promise that when you give financially, God will increase your finances. Other churches might promise that. We don't. We just don't guarantee that God is going to behave that way in your life. Now, that said, it is remarkable how often God does seem to behave that way. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard around here, my short time around here. Stories of people who have reported that kind of experience after turning on or turning up their generosity. But ultimately, that is not a guarantee we can give. What we do guarantee, however, is that God will bless you in return. If not with financial abundance, then with another, richer kind of gold. If not with financial freedom, then with a freedom from a different, more destructive kind of bondage. If not with the joy that can come alongside material wealth, then with a far more secure and lasting, deeper kind of joy. Look at me up here talking about this with you. I feel like I'm standing among some giants. So many of you have lived such exemplary lives of generosity for years, for decades, pouring out your life for the sake of others. So many, countless stories of anonymous envelopes with rent money, paying for a stranger's groceries in the grocery store, paying for someone else's rooted registration, camp registration. Some of you living radically, choosing to live radically below your means, so that you can give a much larger percentage of your income. Sharing your lives, your tables, your homes with open hands, eager to share. And you've learned that the way that looks risky, even crazy, in this world is actually the safer, more secure way. You've learned that it is the way of the abundant life. In your contentment, in your gratitude, may God's brand of joyful, life-giving generosity grow in your life. And in your generosity, may he give you lives of abundance, lives rich, overflowing with good works, and of course, hearts of the purest gold.